And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where at some point over the weekend, I believe the NBA conference finals are set to resume, and we're going to hit both of them on one big podcast, starting with the Eastern Conference Finals. And our man on the ground there, or one of many, is the great Brian Windhorst. How you doing, sir?
Hey, Zach. How are you?
I'm good, brother. How's life?
I love this break. Sorry if I'm in the minority.
No, I do too. I actually do too.
Also, the combine is going on, and so it, you know, I know that people don't care that much about the combine, but it allows the combine to flow a little bit. And everybody would be bitching, you know, if the Celtics were to sweep this series. They would have 12 days off before the finals had they not had this break. So, you know, part of this is to set the finals to make sure there isn't this big, huge delay then as well.
Yeah, I don't really care. Thursday, last night, I got in late from Chicago. My flight out of the combine was super delayed, so I would have been way behind had there been a game last night. And tonight, we're going to book our summer vacation, which is always like a 90-minute nightmare of connections and trying to figure out the flight times and locations and where we want to go other than Croatia. So it's going to be a fun night in the Low household. It was either that or putting together a new bed for our daughter. And you might be shocked to know that I am not good with my hands. It's not in my skill set. And
I pay the fee for them to set it up.
So, I am pro paying for all of that, and my wife, coming from a culture where, like, her dad literally built their house, or her grandfather, rather, literally built their house with his, like, bare hands, just sort of thinks that men are not supposed to be as incompetent as I am. And I'm like, no, I'll pay the people who actually know. Anyway, it just Friday night, this is what it's going to be in the Low household.
All right.
You wrote a great piece on the Cavs suffering from organizational fatigue. Jason Lloyd, the wonderful Cavs beat writer and generally jolly soul for The Athletic, wrote just a massive recap of Game 2 that sort of doubled as an obituary for the Cavs. And it felt like Game 2 was so bad, and particularly the second half was such a complete collapse on both ends of the floor, that everyone just sort of rode ahead to – what does it mean if they just lose this series? And so my question for you is, considering that they haven't played a home game yet, and the Indiana series felt at times like the Cavs were just dying on the court and they pulled it out, are we perhaps jumping the gun here, or are we not?
Okay, so I definitely believe the Cavs can come back in this series. I think Jason... It was funny. Jason and I were at TD Garden till after 3 a.m. working on those stories, sitting about 8 feet apart, not talking to each other. And I think he is more down on their current situation. I was sort of referring to their just overall, just the way that they were operating on the court. The best way I could say is, like, if the Celtics got beat on a bad switch or like a defensive mistake and it was a screw up, they would look at each other and say, "What are you doing, man?" And one guy would say, "My bad." And if the Cavs got beat on a defensive switch or something, the one guy would look at each other and say, "I've hated you for 4 years." Or at least he would say it with his eyes. And I think that's really the difference in a primal difference in the two teams right now, is that the Cavs have all this baggage and they bring it with them everywhere. And it's the nature of having a run like this together. And I know that a lot of the players are new, but you know, there's a spirit that exists within the team. I would love to be able to have a candid conversation with a guy like Larry Nance Jr., because to come into this situation midstream and to feel and to see what goes on with this team and the difficulties and challenges and you know, I mean, just think about this year alone. I mean, guys throwing soup, you know, Kevin Love having panic attacks, you know, Derrick Rose going on a 2 month or a 2 week like mental health break.
I forgot about that. I just literally forgot that Derrick Rose was on the Cavs until you mentioned his name.
Dwayne Wade coming in training camp and LeBron being thrilled, but the rest of the team being upset, and Ty Lue having to take a break to deal with health issues, and Dan Gilbert's son having brain surgery and then recovering enough to be on the lottery show, and Dan, because it was so important to his son and they have such an incredible history at the lottery and just an uplifting recovery from his son to come to the lottery, you know, meanwhile his team's playing the conference tournament or conference finals. This, you know, to step into this is really heavy, Zach. There's a lot of heaviness. It's just, and it carries on the team, and it just makes everything that they do a little bit harder. And so that's what I was referring to when I talk about organization.
Oh, I know you're not writing them off. It has the vibe. By the way, what a career for Larry Nance. Three seasons. Season number one is the Kobe retirement tour, and season number three, you get traded to LeBron's team in a complete spasm where the Cavs remake their entire team. You start for a bit and become this like, maybe he was the missing piece. You take your dad's retired number and it's a wonderful thing and you're in the dunk contest with him. And then now you don't play for a while. And then in game two, suddenly you play and the Cavs like completely bizarrely do not play any lineup with Kevin Love at center until late in the third quarter of game two when it's getting out of hand. It's just what a whirlwind for Larry Nance Jr. Some of these rookies, I was talking to, he's not a rookie, but some of these young guys, like I was talking to Josh Jackson at the lottery. God, do I love the lottery. And it's just, all I wanted to ask him was, you come into the NBA after, I assume he was one and done in college, right? So 1 year in college, you come to the NBA and it's like your coach gets fired. Three games into the season, your best player is banished from the team and tweets, get me out of here, and then says he was at a hair salon. And it's like you just – what you see as a 19-year-old is like, what Larry Nance has seen in 3 years is, like, incredible.
I know, and that's the thing. Like, that's what's sort of wild. That's also the reason why the Cavs can come back. I mean, the other thing is the Celtics have not been good on the road in the playoffs. I mean, remember the Bucks series, they were up 2-0 when that series came to Milwaukee, although it feels like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown and Terry Rozier have grown 2 feet since then. But it did happen. They were up 2-0 after that series, went in and lost 2-0 in Milwaukee. And, you know, the Cavs can be pretty potent. And you know, at the end of the day, I mean, we can analyze 1,000 different things. The Cavs are shooting 25% from three-point range. That is their great panacea. When they hit some three-point shots, all of their other ails become a little bit more manageable. So now they're not doing that in a vacuum. The Celtics are contesting those shots beautifully. They're playing great defense, but the Cavs have missed quite a few beautiful looks. And so they all of a sudden return to form on threes. I had the stats run for me by ESPN Stats and Info since the trades, because I think they've been particularly reliant on threes since the trades. In wins, they make about 4 more threes per game than in losses. And that's obviously a huge difference. And so, basically, if you walk into a Cavs game, you don't have to even look at the score. Just if I walked into a Cavs game in the middle of the second quarter and said, what are they from the three-point range, and you gave me the report, I could guess how the game is going. And so that's going to be like the most important number for them. It's not a healthy way to play basketball, but it's the reality for them.
They're getting fewer threes, also to credit Boston's defense. Some of that is pace, but they're getting fewer threes, and they're getting fewer corner threes specifically. They're 1 of 10 on corner threes after two games. And look, game two just had a vibe. They were up by like 12 or 11 late in the second quarter. Boston scored. Marcus Smart stole LeBron's outlet pass with like 12 seconds left in the half, and they scored again, and it was down to 7 or something. And that, when that happened, I remember thinking, ooh, that feels important. And then in the second half, they just rolled over. And it had the vibe of, a lot of the possessions had the vibe of game three, I believe it was, in Indiana. Whenever LeBron did not have the ball, and you've written about this, his tendency to rest on the floor, which is understandable given the load he's carrying for this team, he just stood at half court or on the wing and blew his hands to make sure they were warm and did nothing. And they just there was one. Do you remember one possession where they ran a pick and roll and they had Kevin Love with a mismatch on him? I believe he had Rozier on him, and then they transitioned into a dribble handoff, which the Celtics then switched because they're switching everything, and the mismatch was gone. And the possession ended with Tristan Thompson dribbling like a toddler, just sort of in random directions for 4 or 5 seconds, like, oh, right, left, diagonally, and then throwing up a floater while LeBron just stood there. And I was like, man, That's just dysfunctional. That's just dysfunctional NBA offense. It had that vibe of just like they just sort of stopped playing basketball.
Well, the other thing is in the Toronto series, they developed a Korver Love off-ball screen that pretty much brought the Raptors to their knees and was just indefensible, and the Celtics have figured out a way to prepare for that. And because the Cavs don't play with any pace, as you said, they maybe get one action in a possession. So they come down, they run one action, the Celtics take it away because that's what a good defensive team does. And then it's like, okay, now it's LeBron to ISO or somebody to ISO, or they hunt for a bad three because they don't play with the pace either to get up the court or to get into their offense fast enough where they can run multiple actions. So that's a combination factor. Again, it's the Celtics being good and prepared and playing good D, but also the Cavs letting them off the hook.
Well, I mean, the Celtics defense has been incredible all season, and I'm almost tired of me gushing about it, but like, it's just, they don't make mistakes, and they're long, and they play so hard. And so like, when Baines comes in the game, whether Horford is also on the floor or it's just Baines in a smaller lineup, LeBron immediately transitions into spread pick and roll mode. Like, let me attack Aaron Baines, have Tristan or Nance or whoever screen for me. And you think that's going to be like a profitable way to go for them. And on a couple possessions here and there, it has been. But A, Baines has been really good. And B, the other Celtics off the ball are so good at shrinking the floor. Like, Al Horford will take an extra step away from Kevin Love spotting up than most big men would because he knows I'm good enough to recover to Kevin Love if LeBron passes there. And that's just not being faster than an average big man. That's, as Tom Thibodeau would say, rotating back with the flight of the ball. Like, he's not a second late. The minute, like, the ball is still on LeBron's hands and Horford reads it and is rotating back there, and Jaylen Brown is good at that, and Marcus Smart, my God, he's everywhere. He can get away with gambles that nobody else on the Celtics can even get away with. Their defense has been really good, and I love that when the Cavs decided to start Tristan Thompson, Stevens didn't blink. He didn't start Baines. He said, we're going to start the same way because we like and we like the Horford-Kevin Love matchup. To your point, that Korver-Love two-man ballet has been completely erased from this series because the Celtics can just switch it when Al Horford is on Kevin Love. And we're not starting Baines. We're going to keep Marcus Morris on LeBron because we like that matchup. And we're going to take our chances with Jaylen Brown and sometimes Morris and sometimes Smart guarding Tristan Thompson. And we're going to take our chances because we want to be switchable and mobile as many minutes as possible. And if Tristan Thompson starts beating us up on the offensive glass, maybe we'll adjust, but not until then. And he didn't beat him up on the offensive glass. I thought that was really, really smart because my anticipation was as soon as they start Thompson, Stevens is going to start Baines to counter. And I think that's a win for Cleveland if he does that. And he didn't do it. And the gambit of putting a wing on Tristan, which just makes you even more switchable, is something that very few coaches have the courage to do because they fear his offensive rebounding so much. And I like that Brad's base assumption was you got to prove it first. And I mean, do you think Tristan starts game three? Do you think they stick with that?
Hard to say. I mean, the stat that I know the Cavs have that I saw was that LeBron's shot distance with Tristan on the court is 19 feet. And with Tristan off the court is 11 feet. The spacing differential is just enormous. They are designed to play with four shooters around LeBron. And when there's only three, their offense just doesn't function the same way. So I don't know. It's a hard call.
And the problem the related problem to what you just said was, you know, when they play LeBron and Tristan and Jeff Green together, it's been a disaster the entire playoffs. And Jeff Green played, I think, 28 minutes or something in game two, which just is way too many. And I'm sorry to pick on Jeff Green, who's probably a very nice person. He's just not good. And I'm sick of watching Jeff Green.
He had five turnovers.
More than that, I'm sick of watching him catch a ball wide open from three above the break and immediately touch pass it to somebody else who isn't wide open. If he's not going to shoot that, he just can't be on the floor. He either has to shoot that or drive it on the catch so that he gets to the rim, which he's actually good at. And the problem we're talking around, of course, is all of the other wing players who could take those minutes, other than Korver, have been a complete disaster. Clarkson didn't even play. Hood is lost somewhere in the depths of his own brain. Remember that offensive foul that Hood drew when he caught the ball in transition, wide open from three, did not even look at it, just sort of like put his head down and something resembling dribbled into the lane and fell over and got lucky that they bailed him out with an offensive. Like, they just, I don't know what's happened to him, except everything that the Jazz thought would happen to him has happened.
He's still average. Look, even if you don't think he's a cornerstone player, he still averaged 17 points. I mean, the guy still made baskets. Jordan Clarkson has scored since he was 8 years old. I don't understand why the guys aren't scoring baskets, but to me, the Cavs are getting so little effort. And by the way, this is one of the difficulties for Ty Lue, because he's getting roasted in Cleveland. But there's so the consistency of this entire team is so non-existent. And I recognize from series to series that different players play different roles. But, you know, Jeff Green was a really valuable player in the Raptors series. He's such a flexible player. And there were times in the Raptors series where he was playing defensive center and offensive point guard. And he was making really good decisions with the ball. Like, he really was good. In a game like that where Jeff Green plays seven more minutes than Kyle Korver, who was like their only bench scoring option, it's just hard to fathom. The other thing is, if the Cavs are going to be so lethargic just in general, you've got to put your energy players in the game. So, like, I watched Larry Nance. Now, Larry Nance played 11 minutes. He had two steals, the only two steals the Cavs had. He had three rebounds, and then he was so fiercely going after a loose ball that he and Baines got into that.
Oh, that was awesome.
War on the court.
That was great.
Larry Nance showed more energy in those 11 minutes than like seven Cavs players combined. And I would consider playing Jetty Osman as well, because Rodney Hood is giving you zero. So, I would consider Osman, Nance, and I would play Kyle Korver more than 21 minutes. Because Korver is, you know, poor defensively, and he's attacked by the Celtics, which is true. But Korver is very active offensively, and that sticks out like a sore thumb as well.
He's been essential to their team in the playoffs. They have to. I don't know how you play, how you start Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love, how J.R. Smith vomits all over himself on both ends of the floor for however many minutes he played in Game 2. I mean, he could not. J.R. could not play a worse game than he played in Game 2 if he tried to. I don't know how all that happens. And the lineup of George Hill, Kyle Korver, LeBron James, Kevin Love, Tristan Thompson has played 0 seconds in the entire series. Like, I might start that lineup. And it just, I don't know how you play big and don't get to that lineup for a second. I just don't get it. It's just sitting there staring you in the face.
You know how, like, sometimes in baseball when a pitcher, like, gives up, like, back-to-back home runs, and he just hits the next guy. He just hits him, and he gets thrown out of the game.
It's exactly what I would do if I were a baseball pitcher. By the way, I would be. I would just hit people.
Kind of like, I don't know if your listeners know the movie Major League. It's one of my favorite movies.
If they don't, I know. I want them to stop listening to the podcast.
But you know, he gives up the grand slam. Ricky Vaughn gives up the grand slam that hits the next guy in the middle of the back, and Bob Uecker says, "About time. It's 8-0." And that's what I felt like when J.R. Smith pushed Al Horford. He wanted to, that was basically what that was.
Oh, by the way, Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson, 100% right. That should be, that's a no-brainer ejection. Not only that, if you, like, he didn't even, sometimes you get those shoves in midair that are almost the accidental byproduct of, like, a legitimate attempt to block a shot or make a basketball player. That was just J.R. being a jerk. I mean, and to me, not only is that a flagrant 2 ejection immediately, if it's just a shove like that of somebody who's in the air, I think the NBA should consider suspending anybody who does that. I mean, that play ruined Andrew Bogut's career. I mean, that is as dangerous a thing as can happen. I don't understand how you can review it the next day and it's still a flagrant 1.
JR expected to be thrown out based on the way he was like, yeah, it was a flagrant. I think JR, and by the way, had JR been thrown out of that game, which he should have been, I don't know about a suspension, but he definitely should have been.
I'm not saying JR, this is not about JR. I'm saying that play when it's not a basketball play.
Though.
What?
But I think it is about JR. It would have been, this is how crazy JR's history is. Had he been thrown out for that foul, which he should have been, it would have been the third different time he would have been ejected from a game, from a playoff game in Boston. He's already been ejected from two playoff games in Boston for flagrant twos. It would have been his third flagrant two ejection.
I like that. And, that's a good history. That's good. That's a good note. One of them was with Crowder, right? Did he elbow Crowder in the face? That's one, right?
He, when he was with the Knicks, he leveled Jason Terry with an elbow.
Yes.
And then he elbowed Crowder after the Olenek Love thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to your point, Tristan is an energy player, by the way, which is why they may default back to starting him. I thought they just gave up on the Love at center minutes way too dramatically. And I wonder, the only times in the whole series when their offense has been, has even resembled what it was against Toronto, is when Love is at center and Baines is at center without Horford on the floor, so he has nobody else to guard other than Love. They've gotten great looks at that, out of that, and I just wonder if there's a way for Ty Lue to, the minute Horford has to go out of the game to rest, because Horford can't play 48 minutes, you find a way to get that matchup, to go right to Love at center. Of course, Brad Stevens is not an innocent bystander in that he can maybe play, just take Baines out and play no centers, because Al Horford, again, has to rest. But that's the only, that's one lineup tweak that maybe possible for Ty Lue. Other than that, they just got to run more offense.
They just got to run more, period. That would be a good place to start.
I mean, they had a play early in the game. So Kevin and Tristan were both on the floor. They're playing big. Where it was so simple. It was, I believe, JR, Love and Tristan were at either elbow. Love was at the left elbow. JR ran a little curl around Kevin Love at the left elbow, which the Celtics either didn't want to switch or were just sort of surprised that Cleveland was running something that was a real play. And JR caught the ball and got to the rim for a lot wide open layup, which he of course missed. But Tristan's man had to come down from the other elbow and help on that layup. And so Tristan just walked in and tapped the ball in. And it was exactly like, if there are just so many little things they can do. Even with Tristan clogging the paint, like if they just run more George Hill, Kevin Love, like Boston's going to switch that a lot. And Kevin Love is going to be able to post up. And Tristan got a layup out of that because they doubled off of him. It's just like these little, you know, little plays that they're just not using enough. I'm really curious to see how they come out at home. You must be too, right? You must be excited to see how they look.
George Hill played 28 minutes in game one, had no rebounds and no assists. I think he had one assist in game two. George Hill played really well in the Toronto series. He's a major factor.
I'm beginning to think that they could put you or I on the court against the Raptors and we would suddenly start making threes.
Right, but I mean, like, that's the thing. Like, I can't, like, if you're Ty Lue, you know, you're getting roasted for playing and doing things that were just working like 6 days ago. So, and this is the nature of this team, by the way. They have no consistency. It's one of the reasons why they're not a real contender. They, you know, they may smoke and mirrors their way. I mean, they smoke and mirrors their way through the Pacers series. It's reasonable to maybe think they could smoke and mirrors. I don't, it's going to be really hard, but they could maybe smoke and mirrors their way through this series, I suppose. But they're just, they don't have any of the traits of a championship team. And consistency and defensive habits being right up there. And so when Ty Lue makes moves, he just has no clue whether that player is going to deliver or not. And, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is when you look at the Cavs, and this is another thing I mean by organizational fatigue, other than LeBron and, like, maybe, like, Jose Calderon or Jetty Osman, how many of those players are actually performing to the level of their contracts?
I think Love, for the most part, has probably been close.
Okay. I mean, he was really good in game two, but he's been absolutely god-awful in certain games in this postseason.
Other than that, I mean, George Hill makes 20. Boy, oh boy. Korver. I mean, so, Korver at 7.
Okay, you're right. Okay, yeah. But my point is, like, I'm not even talking about the amount of the contract. I'm just talking about, like, what you're looking at with the Cavs, which is a bunch of guys who are sort of either their best days are somewhere in the future or somewhere in the past, versus a team where that is ascendant. And you know, I you know, LeBron, for example, you know, Mark Jackson was like sort of urging him to do more. You sort of made a reference to certain plays that he's just, he's not as involved offensively. He had a 40-point triple-double, and he threw 16 passes that led to shots. He had 16 assist chances in Game 2, and 12 of them were makes. He was 12 of 16. So, yeah, he threw a couple of bad passes, but not only was he an incredible scorer, despite a clogged lane because of Tristan, you know, he was shooting distant from distance, but his passing was so phenomenal that they scored on 12 of the 16 assist chances.
If they just
run, there's a desire to go more because they need it so bad from him.
If they just run more stuff, they'll get, even with Tristan on the court, they'll get better looks. Like the LeBron George Hill two-man game to me is still underutilized, and Boston has various adjustments they can make off of that. They can hide Terry Rozier somewhere else if they need to. They can play Smart at point guard and Horford at center, which they played my Smart, Brown, Tatum, Morris, Horford monster lineup in Game 2, where they can literally switch 1-5. So they have counters. But, you know, when LeBron draws attention in the post, when he has a little bit of a mismatch, that's when Tristan and Nance can flash for those lobs that LeBron is so good at finding when their guys shade over to him. And I just didn't, that kind of activity, just wasn't there. And by the way, Tristan, the other problem is, if Tristan's going to play this much, he's got to be like a monster plus defensively. And he was bad. In Game 2, he was bad. He blew switches. Marcus Morris beat him one-on-one in isolation for an and-one. He just wasn't – he took weird angles on a couple of pick-and-rolls and got burned. Like, he needs to be a stopper. And if he's not a stopper, like 75% of his value is gone.
By the way, speaking of Marcus Morris it's probably the fourth best transaction that the Celtics made in the last year, but what a tremendous trade that is, because they lowered their salary with that trade. It was Avery Bradley for Marcus Morris. Am I correct remembering that?
Yeah, and not only that, they have Marcus Morris next year for $5.3 million, whereas Avery's
right,
a free
agent.
Right,
well, he's got one of the best. That goes back to this really bizarre extension discussion that he had with the Suns, which is, you know, if you ever want Exhibit A, why never to trust an organization, the Morris Twins extension is Exhibit A. That goes back to that wild thing. But in that trade, by the way, they reduced their salary, which helped them clear space to sign Gordon Hayward. So it was a functional salary dump trade.
Yeah, that's why they did it.
But they did it and got a player that is useful against LeBron. Now, I'm not one of these guys who says, oh, he's a LeBron stopper. Clearly that doesn't exist right now. But he is a very useful player, and he's a flexible player. And so, you know, great organizations, everything matters. Everything in a trade matters. Stuff that we just sort of pass on, you know, oh, this pick swap or whatever. Like, great organizations fight for every corner. And, okay, they had to reduce salary. They didn't want to sign Avery Bradley long-term, so they had to make this move. They hunted and found a move that accomplished two goals with one, and it's helping them right now. I don't know what percentage it's helping them, but it's helping them.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so that's just – and can I just get on my soapbox about the Celtics for 2 seconds?
Yeah. I've never seen a soapbox. When did soap stop coming? Why was soap in giant boxes that you could stand on? When did that
great
stop?
Question,
when did that stop happening? Anyway.
Well, you know, I used to, when Sage Steele used to do, like field sports center work, I used to have to stand on a box when I would be next to her because she's so much taller than me in general. And then she would wear these high heels and she would be like 7 inches taller than me. One of my most emasculating moments early in my career, we were doing a live shot in Miami where I was talking to Sage during the Heat, one of the Heat finals. And they said, hey, we need to reset the shot a little bit. And they had me come out of this spot, and they went out and they found a box and they put it down. I'm like, hey, actually, could you step on this box? So I stood on this box, and then they lined up the shot again. And then they go, hold on 1 second. And I heard the director whisper to the cameraman, go get the bigger box.
I had to get two boxes.
So I'm on my Sage Steel leveling box
with,
of the Celtics. Number one, and we are flagrantly guilty of this at our company. Can we stop deifying Brad Stevens and completely ignoring how good his players are playing?
I don't think anybody is actually doing that. I saw,
the headline on ESPN.com this morning, the headline main story, is Brad Stevens more valuable than a superstar?
Well, that was what the post was about. And Kevin skillfully used that gambit to sort of discuss the value of a coach in general and how many coaches are clearly a player. I just feel like there's this pushback to, well, everyone thinks the Celtics players are bad or not this good. But everyone is pointing out that the Celtics players are also good. I do think their development is ahead of the curve. Okay. I am in some sort of vague agreement with you, but I don't think,
well, you know who is in agreement with me?
Brad Stevens.
That's right. And he's not doing it because he's humble. I think he's probably concerned. Because, you know, I talk about organizational fatigue. If, you know, right now everything's on the honeymoon for the Celtics, this is wonderful. Eventually these guys are going to get sick of, blood, sweat, and tears, and then the coach keeps getting credit. I mean, I'm not denigrating Brad Stevens at all. I'm just saying let's take a step back before we say that he's winning the series for the Celtics, okay?
What other soapbox point did you have? I feel like this is going to be a multi-pronged soapbox.
Yeah, it was a double prong. Prong two. Everybody's talking, and I shouldn't say everybody. There's a lot of chatter about, oh my gosh, maybe the Celtics should trade Kyrie or Gordon Hayward or something. No. They shouldn't do anything. They should let this team marinate out and see what you have. I do think that there is potentially a bit of an top heaviness that they may have to alleviate, but the concept that they should trade Kyrie or Gordon Hayward this summer, I think, would be lunacy.
No, I don't think they're going to do that. They're not going to do that. They want to see what the team is, and they're not going to trade anybody until they face. They're not going to trade anyone unless just a crazy offer just walks into their lap.
I have an offer. I have a crazy offer, though.
Okay, what's your crazy offer?
Has anybody noticed what's going on in Minnesota with Karl Towns and that organization?
It's not. Darren Wolfson alluded to a lot of it on a podcast a couple weeks ago. They're not in a good, and I said on some podcast recently that I just have a gut feeling that something crazy is going to happen there this summer. It's not in a good place right now internally.
If I were the Celtics, I would make a quiet call to Minnesota.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay, so I brought up the Hayward-Kyrie thing with Simmons the other day, and I agree with you. They're going to let the team marinate. They're not going to do anything until A, the monster offer, or B, crippling tax payments, which they are not even that afraid of anyway. And if Marcus Smart takes his qualifying offer this summer, which he may well do, they're going to be able to get under the tax next year. So there's no rush to do anything. But if you know the Celtics, and I know you do, they are out of the box thinkers and they're very aggressive, and they traded Isaiah Thomas after he played through a hip injury that might ruin his career and became a folk hero. They will have no qualms about doing something that is somehow a correct move involving any of those players.
Well, if they could get, I don't think that Minnesota would do this deal. I'm not saying if Minnesota called and said, hey, would you take Towns for Carl, or if you take Towns for Kyrie Irving, that's an interesting conversation. I just don't think that's a realistic conversation.
No, I don't think.
But I would just say, though, if the Celtics were looking for, you know how they look for opportunities and sort of lay in wait, that might be one right there. Because I think, like, I don't think Anthony Davis is going anywhere anytime soon. But Carl Towns, now that might be a different story.
Could you imagine, by the way, if the Celtics signed Gordon Hayward, reunited him with his beloved college coach. Then he shattered his leg and worked his way back and came back for them. And then in next year's trade deadline, they trade him. That would just be unbelievable.
Well, the trade deadline is a different conversation. That's a different conversation. I'm just saying now I don't think you do that because I'm seeing people talk about that now. You see what's going on with the team. But by the way, the reason that the Carl Towns thing is interesting is under the new rules, you retain Supermax rights if you're traded on your rookie contract.
Yes.
And
now you're just stirring the pot. You're just stirring the pot.
Well,
you know who's gonna have a field day with this?
The aggregators.
The aggregators.
Yeah.
Nothing makes you more furious than that.
I know. It's impossible to have a nuanced conversation. I'm just saying, is anybody notice what's going on with Carl Towns? That's the only question. I'm not reporting anything. I just asked a question.
All right. You've got to go get to Cleveland, and I've got to call Tim McMahon. Wendy, enjoy reading your coverage as always. I look forward to seeing you somewhere very soon.
Thanks, Zach. Take care.
Talk to you. On to the Western Conference Finals, where I want to welcome in the great Tim McMahon, who's been kicking butt out west all playoffs, and wrote recently about how the Rockets had built their team for this series specifically and was in the house when they ran, and I mean ran, Golden State off the floor in a very impressive and to some degree unsustainable Game 2 blowout. And Tim will be heading to the Bay for Game 3. How you doing, bud?
I'm good, man. How about you?
Hanging in. We got a maximum of 17 games left in the NBA season, and I was very, although I watched the game at a bar in Chicago, where there were a lot of Warriors front office people there that I was hanging out with and around. I was very happy that the Rockets won that game, because if they hadn't won that game, we were looking at just a Golden State bloodbath all the way through, and now we have something interesting. I assume you felt the same way. So what are you, as we go to Game 3, I like this break, because the terms of engagement at least through now have kind of been set, and we can talk about how I think the series is being played a little bit more on Houston terms than Golden State terms. But what are you most curious about now the teams have 3 days off going to Oakland? What's your first thing that you're going to be looking for when Game 3 tips off in the first quarter?
You know, honestly, the thing I'm most curious about is, are we going to see the real Steph Curry in this series? And I think there's a few different things going on there. Clearly, the guy is coming back from injury, says the knee feels fine, but you know, we're talking about a guy who really for about 2.5 months has played precious little basketball. There's no possible way to be dealing with the kind of injuries he's dealing with that he can be in game shape. And then the Rockets put a big bullseye on him, and they are going after him, making him work so hard defensively. You know, our stats and info people tell us that he's been targeted 43 times in two games, which is about twice as often as he was on a regular basis during the regular season, during last series against the Pelicans. And I really do believe that has if not a direct, at least some correlation to the fact that he has shot the ball so poorly. To work that hard on one end when you're not in your normal game shape, I just think it's tough for him to have his legs on the other end. And if you get this version or at least a significantly lesser version of Steph Curry, then obviously that drastically increases the Rockets' chances to pull off what would be an upset, despite the fact they're the number one seed.
Yeah, it would be an upset. Steph is 2 of 13 on threes so far. That's going to change. But I think their game plan, I think their defensive game plan has been smart, and it's clearly, you know, it's interesting to watch the subtle differences in how Harden is guarded and how Curry is guarded, because on some of those Harden step back threes where he got rolling in the first half, I think Livingston and maybe Andre on separate plays, when they were defending him, they had one or both feet below the 3-point arc. And yeah. I know that's a Steve Kerr no-no. I know they think you got to be up on him, even though he's so good driving. And for Curry, I mean, Capella is just going to wherever if he goes back to half court, Capello's going with him. Like they're defending him like the Spurs did. They are not going to let him shoot threes. And for all the concerns about his health and all that, he looked really good driving against Capella. Crazy hard finishes around the rim. And I think Houston has correctly made a decision. Like, we're going to live with him making those shots. We're not going to give him threes. We're not going to give him room to take step back threes. And when he drives the lane, or when KD drives the lane, we're helping even more aggressively off Iguodala and Draymond Green, and we're going to make those guys make shots. And I think, I believe those two combined are 0 of 5 from 3 through two games, which is A, not enough attempts probably, and B, obviously 0 is a disaster. When PJ Tucker in one game makes more threes than those two guys have taken combined in two games, that's a problem.
And you know, PJ Tucker, I always felt like was going to be a huge key to this series. And certainly that's played out in the first couple games. And obviously the Rockets need him on the floor a ton because of his defense, you know, the versatility, the toughness, the communication, and especially if Luka Mbamute is going to be unplayable because he has zero confidence in that shoulder, because he can't make a layup. He won't even try to dunk because he dislocated it twice trying to dunk. That even ratchets up the importance of Tucker. But if you look at the games that the Rockets have beaten the Warriors, it's not like they go into a game saying, hey, you know, we've got to get P.J. Tucker. He's not a go-to guy, but he's going to, when he gets shots against the Warriors, he has knocked them down when they've won. He averaged 16 a game in their two wins during the regular season. Obviously, the other night he had 22. But game one, he only got one shot. Getting him, and it's corner threes, and it's the little floaters in the lane, and I think a lot of that also comes with pushing the pace. And it was funny. You know, I'm writing about D'Antoni and kind of the evolution of his offense right now, and it's hilarious to me that Mike D'Antoni is like the defender of isolation basketball now, when he butts heads with Melo about it. He butts heads with Kobe about it, but that's the way the Rockets roll, because they have the best ISO player on the planet, and CP3's on the very short list. But the big adjustment for the Rockets offensively, game one to game two, was, okay, look, got to play with some pace. And I think a lot of that is why you look at Eric Gordon, you look at Tucker, and you look at Ariza. A lot of their stuff, if it wasn't pure transition points, it at least came kind of early shot clock when they were getting out and pushing it, instead of just grinding out every possession.
Well, I thought Chris Paul had 3 points in the first half, and I thought in a lot of ways he was the best, maybe non-KD player on the floor. He completely set the tone for Houston, pushing after makes, pushing after misses, pushing. He's really good at sensing when, like, even there were a couple times where even when they didn't have a numbers advantage, he had like a geographic advantage. Like there was nobody, it was like a 2-on-3. But because of how and where he got the ball, there was nobody in the middle of the floor. So he just like, I'm going straight down the middle, and someone is going to have to help on me, even though we're at a disadvantage, and that's going to leave someone else open. And Tucker got a couple threes out of that. And just his defense was, you know, just his ability to sort of help off of Iguodala, help off of Green when he switched on to him, and read the intentions of the Warriors player. Like, he had an interception on a pass that was headed to Iguodala like a minute or two into the game. I just thought he was all over the place. And even though he only had 3 points, he was the best or second best player on the floor.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned defense. They have to be able to, you know, like, the biggest flaw with the Warriors might be that they get sloppy with the ball. They only turn it over 9 times in game one. That goes up to 15 in game two. The Rockets have to be able to force turnovers. And then, you know, they just can't have the complete breakdowns and brain farts that they do in game one. Like, Klay Thompson can't get three-pointers where he's got enough time to, you know, take a dribble, spin the ball on his finger, see if there's any wind in the arena, order a beer, and shoot. You know, and there was like 4 of those in game one. And it was just a much cleaner, more intense defensive performance by the Rockets. That leads to pace. And then, you know, at that point, they were able to get away with an off night from James Harden, as opposed to game one, where Harden was spectacular in ISO, but they really didn't get anything from anybody else.
I thought Ariza is always, to me, I'm contemplating writing something on Ariza, even though like 0 people are interested in Trevor Ariza. He's like, he's the unsung, not hero, but he's just sort of like, I think he played 35 minutes in game two. Nobody ever talks about him. Everyone talks about the Stars and Capella and Tucker and even Bamute. You know, they just raved about what he's done for them this year and what a big deal his injury that you talked about was. And Ariza's just sort of out there guarding KD in game two, guarding Steph in game one. And you can see the Rockets sort of doing a minute-by-minute calculation of how much shooting do we need on the floor at all times, and what does that mean for how many of Ariza, Bamute, Tucker, and Capella can we all play at the same time? And really, they've concluded we can only play two of them. And sometimes we're going to only play one of them, and it's going to be Ariza with, so they can only play two of them, and Ariza will play with Tucker at center or whatever. And Ariza's like the one guy you don't have to think about. Like, he's a good enough shooter from above the break that you have to pay him some attention out there. Defensively, he can guard a lot of positions. You just don't have to worry about him on either end of the floor. Like, when Gerald Green comes in, you got to worry about what it's going to do to your defense and how you have to fortify the lineups to account for him. When Tucker's in, you have to think about, boy, can we play Mbamute and Tucker together? I believe they've only played 6 minutes the entire series together and none in game two. Who else do we have to have on the floor to balance the shooting? Where does he have to be? Ariza, they just don't have to worry about, and he's out there. And I thought when he attacks closeouts and drives the ball and then makes the next pass, like I believe he had 5 assists in game two. They become like a 5% better team. That dude is just a pro, and no one ever talks about him, and no one gives him any attention, and he's just a pro, and he's just solid.
Well, you know, he's the quote-unquote glue guy, and he kind of always has been. And I think, and I don't know if it's not taken for granted within the Rockets, but I think just kind of a lot of people looking at a team take him for granted because, you know, he's been there. I mean, him and Harden are the only guys who have been there and been factors really for, you know, the last whatever 4 years now. Capella obviously was a rookie who barely played 4 years ago, but their vault from 18 to 6 in the defensive rankings and defensive rating this year, you get a lot of credit to Tucker and Mbamute. Well, Ariza was those guys before those guys got there. Now the big difference is they have three of them. But he was that, he's the guy who has always been their most versatile defender, has always been able to guard 1 through 4. And again, just like Tucker, I think Ariza becomes even more critical in this series just because Mbamute, he played 3 minutes in game two before D'Antoni had to pull the plug. You know, missed a couple more layups. I think it was 0-3. Didn't get back in until garbage time. That's going to be really interesting to see when and if he goes back to Mbamute in game three or in this series. And at this point, you know, Ryan Anderson is out of the rotation. Nene's out of the rotation. And, you know, Tucker is getting the backup center minutes. Just because they are prioritizing defense over what those guys, you know, especially Anderson, can provide in terms of shooting. So, again, that ratchets up the minutes for Ariza as well.
Yeah, they've done a good job finding the right balance of offense and defense, which seems like an easy thing to do, but with some of the pieces they have is tricky. And the key to that has been they've been a little more daring playing Gordon, Paul, and Harden all together, and Golden State, and they've been fine. Like, Golden State hasn't been able to take advantage on offense at all, and Gordon finally got going in game two, and they've been much better. I believe they're plus 19 for the series with Gordon on the floor, minus 10 without him, which is, you know, fine. It's a tiny sample size. They've done a really good job, and to me, the most interesting thing of game two, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts, is can the Warriors get themselves back in rhythm on offense? Because I think Houston switching has taken them out of their game. And look, I mean, KD's on fire, right? Like he is impervious to any defense, but they're going to take KD shooting long twos and not passing because KD's not a great like drive and kick guy out of isolations and post-ups. That's not how he's wired. He's a good passer, just not in that kind of situation. And you could see the Warriors, it's funny how these teams are human, and you want to say, like, oh, just run your stuff, but, like, they're human, and you could see them get out of their rhythm. Remember that fadeaway on the baseline that Klay took, where he just sort of dribbled around and shot? There was, like, 14 on the shot clock. David West posted up twice in a row. Now, they were against guards, so I guess it's okay, but he missed both little mid-range hook shots, and on one of them, the other Warriors players were, like, pointing for him to post up because it was a guard. Andre Iguodala posted up and shot and, like, took a jumper with, like, 14 on the shot clock. KD posted up Chris Paul at the nail and just sort of, like, that's an okay matchup, but he tried to draw a foul and sort of flailed around. Like, that's not
right.
That's not how they play. And you could see one possession early in the second quarter. It might have even been after that Klay shot. It was at, like, they took a bad shot on one possession early in the shot clock. Then the second possession, they entered the ball to someone in the post, and no one did anything. And Steve jumped off the bench and started, you know, motioning with his hands, can we move? Can we move? Can we move? Like, they're out of rhythm, and it doesn't – maybe in the macro sense, it doesn't really matter when they get out of rhythm because they're so damn good. But it mattered in game two, and I'm just very interested to see how they try to get their mojo back a little bit.
Yeah, and look, the Rockets' entire defensive scheme, the whole switch everything scheme, that's designed with the Warriors in mind. I mean, obviously they do it against everybody, but when they're, you know, completely remaking their defensive identity over the summer and then, you know, into the season, they are thinking about how can we beat the Warriors. I mean, Daryl Morey has done everything but put up a billboard about his obsession with beating the Warriors, and that's what that was all about. And, you know, D'Antoni said after game one, I think some people kind of looked at him funny. Hey, we can, you know, we can live with KD going off like that. We just can't, you know, give guys like Klay Thompson the wide open shots, and, you know, we can't have the defensive breakdowns. But basically what he's saying is, look, if this 7-footer is going to hit ridiculously tough, mid-range shots with, you know, that are tightly contested, hands in his face, tip your cap, you know, say the guy's an all-time great and live with it. But to your point, he goes off, I believe he was 38 in game two, doesn't have a single assist. Nobody else gets in rhythm. And if the fourth or fifth options on the floor are getting post-ups, trust me, Mike D'Antoni, who detests post-ups as much as anybody, is giddy to see that. I mean, that is absolute. If you want to post up David West or Iguodala, and you feel like you have a mismatch, especially, by the way, if that mismatch is against Harden, who actually is a really good post defender, then have at it.
Harden competed much more defensively in game two, and it was interesting that they put him on Klay instead of hiding him, and I think that was to get him a little bit more engaged. Obviously, who you guard at you know, they're going to switch so much it doesn't matter, but
right.
He spent much more time on Klay. And part of that is, I think, to engage him. And part of that is, I wonder if they'd rather start him on a good player and hope that by the end of the possession, he's switched onto a worse player. But, you know, we have this second spectrum tracking data now. For the season, the Warriors averaged 11.5 isolations per 100 possessions. And they were among the most efficient isolation teams in the league because they're the Warriors. In this series, they're up to 27.5. So, like, almost 2.5 to 3 times as many isolations. And, like, no, not even the Rockets averaged 27.5 in the regular season. Like, that's way more.
No, but in this series, the Rockets are 45.
I know, it's crazy. The number looks like a typo.
They had the most ISOs in at least by any team in any game in at least 5 years in game one, got absolutely ripped for it, and then ran one more ISO than that in game two. You know, it's funny, though, because you mentioned Harden being much more engaged defensively. And, you know, game one might have been his worst defensive performance of the season. Obviously, he's got the reputation, but Harden has actually been very solid defensively and competed. And obviously, they try not to make him work too hard on that end, but he's more than held his own defensively and has, you know, been part of their improvement there. Whereas in game one, he got torched. You know, our stats and info people said as the primary defender, he gave up 33 points, which obviously is just an absolutely horrific number. But he lit it up on the other end. You know, he had 41. It was efficient. It was ISO after ISO. And he was 9 of 12 in ISO, a bunch of step back threes. He shot the ball really well. Whereas in game two, he shot it terribly, you know, 3 of 15 on threes. And I wonder how much, just like we're talking about Steph and the way that they target him, the way they're making him work on defense, I wonder how much Harden's effort level on defense impacts his efficiency on offense, especially when there's just one day between games. I think both there's a lot of superstars in the series. I think both Curry and Harden are going to benefit greatly from this big gap between games two and three.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see how both of them come out. The attacking Curry thing, I'm glad you brought that back up. You know, it's funny, depending on where they are in the game and how everyone's feeling, like, you know, everyone knows that wherever Curry is, Harden is going to call his man up to screen for him in hopes of getting that switch. And there are some possessions where the Warriors fight not to switch that, and some possessions where they just give up and switch it right away. And look, Houston is really good at getting that switch. They'll screen it two or three times until the distance between players becomes such that they have to switch. But I kind of like when the Warriors battle to not switch a little bit more. And there was a play early in the second quarter, I think, where Curry hedged out and Ariza rolled to the rim, and it was all pretty sound, and Harden slid the ball to Ariza. So he's in an advantageous position now. Mm-hmm. And the help defense from the Warriors was so good off of Tucker, off of Capella, that I don't believe the Rockets were able to really profit from that. And I like the idea of mix that in a little bit more. Make Ariza make plays, help off the so-so shooters. But then again, you know, Houston, that goes back to how much shooting Houston could put on the floor. When they swap Eric Gordon in for Ariza or for Tucker or for Capella, however you want to rejigger it, that becomes harder to do. But I wonder how much we're going to see the Warriors just sort of let Curry get destroyed on an island possession after possession.
Yeah, and like you said, even if Ariza catches it in an advantageous position, and as well as he played the other day with 19 points and 6 assists and really efficient, you would rather Ariza be in a playmaking position than James Harden, who led the league in ISO points, and the only guy who had even half as many was LeBron, one-on-one against the matchup that he wants. I mean, as much as the Rockets were ripped for ISO, it's like D'Antoni said, did you watch them ready two games? That's exactly what they want to do. It's interesting, though, you're talking about trying to fight to avoid the switch. I remember in game one, Curry actually picked up fouls, like two fouls and really quickly there, where he's just trying to kind of push Ariza off the screen because they were trying to avoid the switch. So, I mean, that whole targeting Curry thing really is a fascinating game within the game. And, you know, hey, they were going to do it if he was completely healthy and had no issues with his knee, no issues with his conditioning. But I think the fact he is coming off the knee and he's barely played over the last 2+ months really makes it that much more of a priority.
And the Warriors have started trying to, when Curry's man starts jogging up to set that screen, they're trying to switch that on the fly. If there's like another Rocket on the way there, they'll try and switch it so that Curry hangs back and another Warrior kind of gets into the play. But that, you know, presents opportunities for like Gerald Green got almost an open three out of that because he realized that there was like this little window between switches where he popped out. It's going to be interesting to see, how they work that. And you're right, the foul trouble with Curry. I mean, this is what the Cavs did, right? I mean, this is not rocket science, no pun intended. Like, this is what the Cavs did. And if you can get them in foul trouble, if you can get them frustrated, it affects their game. And I'm excited for game three. I think it's going to be the fascinating chess match and how the Warriors try to sort of find that flow again that Houston has successfully kind of taken out of the series.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, though. So many people felt like it was going to be an easy series for the Warriors, and I'm not only talking about the TNT guys and just other national media members that are covering the series. I never really understood that. I never got that, and I understand the Rockets winning would be an upset, but this is a team that won 65 games. This is a team that won at Golden State and beat the Warriors at home. I never understood the thought process that it was going to be a cakewalk for the Warriors, as great as the Warriors are.
Yeah, Greenberg and I argued about that on Get Up last week. He just thought it was going to be a roll. And look, they might still win in five. Like, they got the job done. They got one at home, and Pelton has written about this. Higher seeds that lose game one at home have, like, an outrageous record winning game two, because their urgency is heightened, and the road team, particularly a road team as good as the Warriors, knows, okay, we've done our job. Maybe they, you know, maybe they just play with 95% of urgency, and against Houston, that's not enough. But to me, you know, the broader issue with the Warriors that just not enough people talk about is they have six centers on their roster, and the only one that's of any use in this series is Kevon Looney. And that's a problem. Like, Houston is almost better equipped to play super small than the team who has the death lineup. And it's crazy that that's the case. And, like, that goes back to McCaw's injury. I think as bad as he was this season, they were hoping that they could get him ready to go for the playoffs for this reason. You know, I wonder if at some point maybe we'll see Quinn Cook for this reason. But, you know, they're playing Looney a lot. They're playing West a little and then never in the second half. And, you know, when they start the death lineup or the Hamptons Five, whatever you want to call it, like, their only non-centers on the bench that they trust are Livingston and Nick Young. And, like, that's just not good enough.
And the Hamptons Five got lit up.
Yeah.
They got lit up in game two, and, you know, the Rockets can go a couple different ways. They can go with the Tuck Wagon lineup, where you've got P.J. Tucker playing center, or, Capella. And it's funny, because if you look at Capella's numbers against the Warriors in the regular season, I'm talking about plus-minus, it was really bad, especially in the regular season opener. He did get run off the floor. But Capella, to me, where he's made the biggest improvement this year, and you can look at all the numbers and they've all gone up, where he's made the biggest improvement is his ability to guard on the perimeter. I mean, D'Antoni actually referenced Capella after game one as maybe their best perimeter defender. That's some hyperbole, but he has been spectacular during the playoffs guarding elite players on the perimeter. You know, Jimmy Butler, Donovan Mitchell, and, you know, it's to the point now where, look, has Curry been able to get some buckets against Capella on those switches? Yeah, but they've been really tough buckets. You know, same with KD. And so Capella, it's not like it's a glaring mismatch that the Rockets are afraid of. And then, you know, you have to deal with his energy and his length and his athleticism on the other end, and especially on the offensive glass.
No, he's been great. And I think the rotation in game two, and again, they'll change it. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw Joe Johnson in non-garbage time minutes, for instance, in this series. We'll see. They'll change it. But I wouldn't be shocked. But they're Capella 31 minutes and the rest of the minutes Tucker at center, I think is as close to correct as they're going to get. And so, like, Capella needs to play a lot for them to win this series. And he did, even with the maximization of Tucker at center minutes, they still played, Capella a lot. And he's been really good all season. He's good at challenging those shots from behind. Like, when Curry gets inside of him a little bit, those are still really hard finishes for Curry. And their defense, as you said, you know, I'm sitting here saying, I wonder if the Warriors get their mojo back. Like, the Warriors tried a lot of their little tricks that they do to beat switches, like slip screens and backdoor cuts and fake screens and then cut the other way. I mean, they know they're better at that than any team in the league. They've seen the switching stuff a million times before. And in game one, they caught Houston off guard with some of it. And in game two, Houston read all of that stuff really, really well, closed space really, really well. And, you know, it's not as if they're just a passive recipient of, you know, Golden State getting its rhythm back or not getting its rhythm back. The better they are at covering that stuff and reading it, and it's really, really hard. Like, sometimes you're going to screw up. It's really hard. But if you screw up 5 times versus 15 times or 20 times, like, that's the game.
Yeah, you think there's any chance Kerr switches the starting lineup and plugs Looney in there?
But that's part of the issue, right? Is the depth issue. It's not just the centers. It's like KD is their only small ball four, and playing KD at the five, which would be a useful lineup for them, is very difficult to get to because of the depth. It's a lineup I would like them to try a little bit. It wouldn't surprise me, but it just feels like now that they've gone all in, they're going to stay all in. It would surprise me for game three. If game three goes really badly for them for whatever reason, then I think more stuff is on the table. I would be surprised in game three if they switch lineups.
Yeah, it does. It would send them, especially with that Hamptons five having been so successful and that being like this vaunted legendary lineup. It would send, I think, a message of at least slight panic that I don't know that Kerr would want to send. But like you said, if the Rockets are able to have that kind of success against that lineup again, it will be interesting.
I'm going down with, just like I went down with the ship with French Rejection as the better Rudy Gobert nickname than Stifle Tower, I'm going down with the ship of Death Lineup. I think Death Lineup is better. I just think Hampton's five is so hoity-toity, and I know that the Warriors are hoity-toity, so it fits. I mean, they did meet in the freaking Hampton, so it's fine. Uh-huh. I want a more intimidating nickname. Is there a third option, or are those our only two options?
I think the Death Lineup is quality. I also think it's hilarious that Draymond is trademarking Hampton Five.
Oh, it's like, singular? No, he's doing singular?
It's like, Draymond, you didn't meet at the Hampton Inn. You met in the Hamptons. So, yeah, Draymond apparently is he got, Kawakami pointed out on Twitter, Kawakami who coined, Ten Kawakami with The Athletic now, who coined the nickname, pointed out, hey, he's fine with him trademarking it, but he got it wrong.
Didn't Sam Presti stay at the Hampton Inn when he was trying to, after, because they couldn't find a better hotel? Was it? He stayed at some below normal NBA standards hotel on Long Island. This is in the Royce Young story. It might have been a Hampton Inn.
It might have been. And so maybe for Draymond, this is just a really subtle, slick way to take another troll shot at the Thunder. It would be rather strange, but it'd be funny.
I didn't realize he was doing a singular. I guess if they made Hampton Five merchandise, people would buy it maybe, but it is incorrect. All right, Tim, you got to go. Appreciate your time and love all your coverage. What should we look for next? It sounds like a D'Antoni thing. What should prime us for something?
I have got, if I can actually get my brain and my fingers to connect, I will be, I believe, before game three, running something on the evolution of the D'Antoni offense and how he has adapted it to this Rockets personnel to make it completely different than the 7 seconds or less Suns.
I look forward to it. I look forward to all your stuff. I know you're busy. Thanks for taking a little time, and I will see you down the road somewhere soon, my friend.
Always a pleasure. Appreciate you having me.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.